Session number 6184, Reel 1.
Mr. Woodhouse, what were the circumstances of your joining the army?
Well, I joined the Territorial Army in early 1939. I thought the war was becoming inevitable, and I decided to get in something while I had some sort of choice, and I joined the 2nd London Divisional Signals at Clapham Park in Atkins Road in London.
Why did you join the Signals?
Well, I'd always been interested in signal work. My father had been all his life and remained during the Second World War in the Navy and in signals, and I knew a good deal about it, and I thought this was a bit of a start anyway.
What sort of training did you receive?
Well, very thorough training, really. The Army, of course, with its thoroughness, insisted upon putting us through Morse classes at a slow rate of speed, which I found difficult because I could already read at a fair rate. And having seen the relative freedom enjoyed by other sections, notably the people who went out and laid the lines, I transferred and became a lineman. I found it much more entertaining. I was far a good deal further away from the eye of authority, too.
How long was it before the war broke out?
Well, of course, the war started in September of that year. We were then embodied, became regular troops. But by that time, we were fairly well trained, and we were pretty well ready, I suppose, to take the field with the 2nd London Division.
So what happened to the 2nd London Division when the war broke out?
It wasn't quite ready, and for that reason we were changed about it, really, in constitution and various other formations. We went for a time to form the nucleus of 11 Corps at Much Haddam in Hertfordshire, and then from there to Tunbridge Wells, where we formed 12 Corps signals.
Were you becoming impatient at being shuffled around?
I was a bit. I was becoming particularly impatient at the fact that we were really engaged on so much unnecessary, what is still known in the Army as bull, at Corps headquarters, when there was a war on. For example, we were doing work at that time as a signal section. We were ringing towns like Hailsham, Canterbury and places with alternative communications in case of dive bombing attacks, when London presumably would have been bereft of any type of signals, line communication anyway, to the south. And to be called back from work, which was as vital as that in view of the situation, to come back and prepare for a new corps commander's inspection, which meant polishing the sort of grease nipples of lorries and painting team hats, struck me as ridiculous in the extreme.
Was that why you volunteered for the Far East?
Partly. But the volunteering perhaps is the wrong word. I knew there was a line maintenance section being taken out to the Far East, and I had good reason to think that the section sergeant of that section was too old to go abroad, and I volunteered for it and got it.
What was the name of the ship you went out on?
The Stirling Castle, sailed from Liverpool.
And how long did that take?
Crikey, it's over 40 years ago. Excuse me. I suppose about 3 weeks or more, probably, because we stopped at Cape Town for 2 or 3 days.
Was it fairly comfortable?
Very comfortable. I think it was the first trip that the Stirling Castle made as a troop ship, and we had plenty of room.
What rank did you have then?
Sergeant.
Had you travelled much before?
No, only in this country.
So what were your first impressions when you arrived in Singapore?
I loved it. Tremendous interest. We didn't stay in Singapore very long, really. We came through Singapore and went on the train up to Kuala Lumpur.
How long were you in Singapore?
We didn't stay there at all. We went straight off the boat to the station and shifted on, really.
What was your barracks like in Kuala Lumpur?
Pretty good. I think it was a school. Pardon me, it had been used as a school. We were comfortably established there. There wasn't very much to do. The routine was typical, I suppose, of sort of British Army abroad as it had been up to that time, where one worked and paraded and did essential work in the morning, and the afternoon was devoted to sport of some kind.
Was there much contrast between the atmosphere in Kuala Lumpur and the atmosphere in England as you'd left it?
Yes indeed. England, of course, was all geared to war. There's no doubt about that, and whether we were fighting it. But there seemed to me at that time to be, what shall I say, nobody seemed to worry very much in Malaya. It seemed that any idea of war was a long way away, and there was a bland assumption, I think, amongst people, particularly, I think, amongst the civilians, that it couldn't happen there and probably wouldn't.
What sort of jobs were you doing?
Well, I was sent, I was posted to an Indian an Indian division at Sangipatane, because although I'd gone out to Malaya with a line maintenance section, my chief interest was line construction, line laying. And I was I welcomed this move to Sangipatane, because it was a line construction section. And there we were really maintaining lines that had been laid out for sort of peacetime use by the British Army.
It wasn't done with a view to a Japanese invasion?
Oh, no. We were, before the war started, we were working on something rather akin to what we had been doing in England, in fact, because the airfield at Alostar, up near the border, near Jitra, we were doing, we were bringing that with communication as well.
Did you have enough equipment to do what you were doing?
Sometimes, no. It seemed that we couldn't get enough cable for our needs, and rather frustrating, really, because finally, when we got to Singapore, I did find at least one office where drums of cable were being used as sort of blast-proof walls around an office.
And there wasn't much sense then of impending hostilities with the Japanese?
Not really. I think we fell into this trap too of assuming that they wouldn't do it. Here we were, the British Army, with Singapore, Malaya, God's gift to the British as far as defence was concerned, as far as our lectures at that time went with the Brigadier. We didn't believe that Malaya could be invaded. Certainly not from the... We seemed to have a touching faith in the statements of our seniors at that time, that the Japanese couldn't land in the rivers on the east coast because they silted up and the jungle in the middle of the country was impenetrable, and that the guns of Singapore would defend us from any seaborne invasion.
Can you remember who the Brigadier was next year?
Brigadier Heath.
Did you get much news from home?
No, we hadn't been there long enough to get many letters from home. We did correspond. I can't recall receiving very many. My family, of course, or my then wife, knew I'd gone overseas, but she didn't know where. She knew after we'd gone from Cape Town, because people who did befriend us in Cape Town for the 3 or 4 days the convoy was there were very good. They'd entertained us right royally, I may say. And as soon as we'd gone, given a lapse of days, they then wrote to our relatives, friends and wives and so on, to tell them we had passed through. So it must have been obvious then we were on our way to either to India, of course, or Malaya.
How long were you at Kuala Lumpur?
Some weeks.
And where were you sent to next?
Sangipatane, as I indicated, to the Indian division.
How long were you at Sangipatane?
On and off until the Japanese actually invaded. This was interspersed with the so-called exercises. At that time, any troops who stayed any length of time in the rubber country were taken out of it periodically because it was considered not very good for the health, I think. But we went to Butterworth, which is just opposite the island of Penang, ostensibly to indulge in training exercises, but in fact it was a break away from the rubber, and plenty of bathing and every day off in Penang.
And then you were sent up to Alostar, I think.
We went up to Alostar as soon as the Japanese invaded, or when the threat of invasion came. We went up to Alostar to help out with the signals, really, forward to the battalions and so on who were doing the fighting.
Did the invasion come as a surprise to you?
Yes, it did, really. We weren't, I suppose, the average soldier. Pardon me, wasn't closely enough in touch with news to be able to assess for himself the situation. It did surprise us a little. It also surprised us we were retreating so rapidly and so quickly, as soon as we'd established contact.
When did you first see a Japanese soldier?
Well, some weeks after that, really. The first one I saw had been brought in and killed by, I think they were Gurkhas. And he was a very, well, he was a weazened up little man, really. Very little in the way of kit. He'd some jungle shorts, green jungle shorts, and a vest, and a sort of belt that contained some sort of rice or fish powder and some rice. He was virtually self-supporting if he could find water for quite some time. He had some sort of light automatic weapon and plenty of ammunition in bandoliers.
Did he confirm what you'd been told about Japanese soldiers?
In a way, yes. It's fairly obvious he was pretty well self-contained, and to be self-contained and live on one's own, or even in a small group in somewhat inhospitable country, one had to be pretty well trained and had to have very good morale.
Can you describe the process of falling back down the peninsula?
Yes, it was very disappointing, really. You no sooner take up a position than you're taken out of it as well. And I think this conduced to a very large extent, it's my opinion anyway, to the somewhat bad morale that existed in Singapore at the finish.
How long would you be in one position before you had to fall back?
It's a matter of days, really. Bearing in mind the whole campaign, and it lasted from the beginning of December until the 15th of February the following year.
So it was quite quickly that you were back, falling back onto the island of Singapore itself.
Indeed, yes. Yeah.
When you fell back onto the island, did you think that you would at least be able to make a stand on the island?
Well, we assumed that. We assumed that. There was a good deal of water between the... please pardon me. Between the mainland and the northern north of the island, and the causeway having been, as we understood it, blown up, when in fact only about 20 feet had been blown out of it, it seemed that we could at least make a stand there and defend it.
What jobs did you do on the island? Did you carry on being a linesman?
There wasn't a great deal to do. A lot of the lines were already established. You see, the essential weakness in Singapore at that time was that the difficulty in getting cable further up country resulted in our using the post and telegraphs system, which was overhead wire, which, although excellent, was very susceptible to bombing and shell fire and came down in a fraction of time. That had to be replaced and mended as soon as it was interrupted, of course. But other than that, there wasn't very much to do on the island.
Were you under much pressure when you were working? Was it dangerous work?
It varied. A lineman, of course, accepts the fact that if he's repairing lines in an area that's being bombed or shelled, he's got to be there, and it's a risk inherent to the job in hand. Some places it was quite easy, other places not. It got worse as the campaign progressed. For toward the last in Singapore, it was very difficult to keep communication going at all around the perimeter.
Were you under much danger yourself?
No more than anybody else, really.
And so how long did it take you to get to Fort Canning? I think you were...
We were occupied toward the finish. We were just before capitulation. My section was occupying a house at the foot of Fort Canning, which was the headquarters of the garrison of the fortress troops. It was a house, I think, it had been evacuated by its owners, obviously, and they were there.
What was your morale like at that stage?
I wouldn't describe it as terribly good. We've been running away much too much.
Did you feel that you were bound to be taken prisoner?
At that time, I think a lot of us cherished a faint hope that there might be some sort of evacuation, but of course events proved that to be virtually impossible.
Were there any rumours of imminent rescue?
There were rumours which were very soon scotched by the fact that there was no shipping available anyway, and such shipping as there was taking off... civilians, certainly women and so on.
How did news of the surrender reach you?
It reached us in the middle of an afternoon through our officers, when we were told we had to abandon and lay down any weapons we had, which we did, and to foregather in a largish building about a mile away, which I thought, as I remember it, was some sort of engineering works.
Did you attempt to sabotage your weapons at all?
If we could, yes. I mean, the bolts of rifles would be thrown away, provided it wasn't done under supervision. Ours weren't. There was no Japanese supervising our handing in of weapons, and since nobody could check whose they were, we did sabotage at least all of them, I'm certain of it.
Did you see many Japanese at that stage?
No, we just saw the occasional Japanese in the street patrolling.
What was the reaction to the surrender?
Well, I suppose immediately any physical danger vanished, but it was pure uncertainty as to what was now going to happen. This was the point. I think even then, as I say, it's easy to be wise after the event. It seems fairly clear now from records that still exist that the Japanese were then so short of food and ammunition that any sort of determined counterattack could have driven them right the way back. But one's not to know that. And it seems to me it would have been pretty much better, maybe, to fight on, to have a go. But I think what dictated the ultimate surrender as much as anything else was the fact that so many civilians were likely to suffer. Pestilence and so on, the spread of pestilence, because the Japanese controlled 90% of the water supply.
Was there much feeling at the time that you wanted to fight on and that you'd been prevented by the surrender?
Amongst some, yes. Amongst others, no. So, as I say, my own opinion at that time, that morale wasn't too high. It results from running away too much.
How long were you at the engineering works?
4 or 5 days.
What happened there?
We were just wasting time, really. The nominal roles were taken. We believed to have our names sent home via the Red Cross that we'd been taken prisoner. And we were just waiting for orders from the Japanese as to what to do next.
What were you eating?
Eating at that time, such rations as we managed to save and brought with us. It was mainly army biscuit and bits of tinned meat and jam and fruit and that sort of thing.
And you were organised among yourselves, were you?
Only organised in the sense that the soldiers do organise themselves to keep their quarters clean, get themselves decent and shaved and that sort of thing. We had no idea what was going to happen. Nor could our officers help us. Nobody knew exactly what was going to happen. It was just a question of keeping the chaps' morale up as far as possible.
Was that the stage at which there was the rumour about General Wavell?
No, that was later.
Can you tell me about that rumour?
Well, when a week or so after this, when we got to our next port of call, which was Roberts Barracks in Changi, the British Army Barracks, rumours, of course, became rife, as they always do. Pardon me, amongst troops anywhere. One was that the war wouldn't last very long because the Japanese had stretched their lines of communication so far, and that Wavell, who was believed to be fighting in Burma, had cut right across their lines of communication and isolated them. And everybody, therefore, was looking forward to relief in a matter of weeks, or perhaps even days, which, of course, didn't eventuate.
Did anyone try to escape at that stage?
I believe several did, and several, in fact, I think did succeed. I've read books since which seem to prove that I think 4 or 5 men got away to India, ultimately, by boat. But they were extremely lucky to do so. To get out of Singapore at that time by boat meant sailing many miles of hostile ocean, really, with the Japanese in full control. And later, of course, it was found that some Australian nurses who'd got on a boat and were away, their boat was sunk near an island. They were overtaken by the Japanese and massacred.
So the whole section that were in the engineering works then marched to Roberts Barracks?
Marched up to Changi, yes.
Mm. Where were you accommodated at Changi?
Personally, with the unit I was then with, we were accommodated in the what had been the NAFI building.
What was it like there?
Very pleasant. It was a typical British Army barracks of the time, where, you know, large white concrete blocks. It was very pleasant, really. A little overcrowded, but nonetheless acceptable.
Were the forces all separated according to nationality and according to rank?
Not at that time, no. The army never takes long to separate ranks. The The ranks themselves see to that. But the we occupied this building, and it soon became, the hierarchy soon established itself. You had the signalmen or private soldiers, then the NCOs, and then of course the officers who lived in another building entirely.
How were you fed?
Fed in the same way for a week or so as we'd had up till then, a sort of army biscuit and stuff to go with it, which was rather sparse in fact. We were all getting a bit hungry.
And what came to relieve your hunger?
Rice. The Japanese, it was, some chaps welcomed it because they said it filled their stomachs, but it undoubtedly did. But the way it was cooked at the time, of course, our cooks hadn't acquired the expertise necessary to cook rice, and it came out of the cooker in a solid lump, like a brick, and weighing about as much. And although it filled the stomach, it had most dire results in it, in one's internal economy. You either got diarrhea or became terribly constipated.
How much of that did you get a day?
It was about the average of a pint, an army pint mug, three times a day. With something added to it, it might have been a bit of seaweed or some odd bits of meat as we got were rather sparse. Some of us have still had a few tins of bully we managed to take with us, and this helped things out for a time.
Was it at Changi that some old tins of food were dumped?
Oh, yes. We moved from one part of Changi to another. And at that time, we were thinking of starting gardens, and things were looking a bit settled. We had reason to think we'd stay there for some time. And to supplement the rations, we thought we'd buy start some gardening, grow some crops like gourds and things like that, vegetables. And we managed to get some seeds and things from the Japanese, who seemed surprisingly obliging at that time. But there wasn't very much enthusiasm for digging at all, until two chaps who'd been persuaded to go and do a turn on this plot turned up a tin of bully beef that had been dug just below the surface. And it turned out that a unit had been there before expecting the capitulation, had hidden a lot of their food in this way. There it is all over the place. And from that time on, there was no stopping them. You couldn't stop people going down there and digging. In fact, you stood in grave danger of your life if you got to the flying chunkles and picks and shovels. But there was quite a lot of food buried there, which we recovered.
And how was that shared out?
Well, it went to a central depot. You clearly couldn't let everybody who picked it up keep it, because a man could easily overeat himself. The sensible thing, really, to do was to put it in a central store and distribute it as it became necessary and desirable.
Were you doing any work at that time?
Yes, we were. We were working for the officers, the British officers, in fact. The sole purpose, I think, of moving my particular secondary area was to pump water up to the officers' mess from a pumping house, pumping station, a manual thing, which we had to work all day to keep them in baths.
What sort of shifts did you have to work on that?
The men worked an hour shift about. I wasn't supposed to work at the time, being a section sergeant, when I weighed in with them.
How long did that last for?
That lasted for, hard to say now, it's a long way, long time ago. That must have been at least 3 months.
Did it cause a certain amount of bad feeling?
Yes, it did. Amongst the chaps, they could see no reason why they should be working as skivvies, so to speak, for the officers.
And how was discipline maintained at that stage?
It was kept pretty well, I think, by the men's own good sense to a large extent. That there was, in fact, rather an anomaly here. We had a prison camp within a prison camp, so to speak, because anybody who infringed the rules of the British Army too badly, there was a detention centre. It struck me as rather ridiculous, but there it was.
When did you volunteer for the work party at the docks?
Later, the Japanese were then taking working parties to work in the docks, or do work in Singapore generally. Most of the work took place in the docks. And if one did that, there was more food going in Singapore. And I wanted to change anyway, so I thought I'd have a crack at that. I could have stayed at Changi, I suppose, but some of my section was going down, and I decided to go along with them.
Yeah, up until that point, you'd been pumping water mostly, hadn't you?
Yes. And carting rice, that is, shoving a an old lorry which had no engine, loaded with sacks of rice, up a hill to a storage depot. That was very hard work, actually.
How often did you do that?
That was done every 2 days.
And that was for the Japanese?
For the Japanese, partly, and partly for us. It was a distribution centre.
Were you paid at all for that?
I think it was 10 cents a day, which wasn't much good. You couldn't, there was nothing to buy.
So you were moved to the docks. Where were you accommodated?
In an old Chinese amusement park called the the Great World. There was another called the Happy World too. They were typical American Chinese, well, and if you like, native amusement parks. There were sideshows and there were places for dancing and that sort of thing.
How many people were accommodated there?
I never knew the exact total, but here they were a mixture. A lot of Australians in that camp, and we joined them after a while.
What sort of conditions were you personally living in there?
We were living in these sideshows as quarters, and it wasn't unpleasant really. We didn't see many Japs. The Japs used to patrol this camp. We'd be marched out every morning in parties to do some sort of work in Singapore in the docks principally.
Who were you sharing with?
I was sharing with three Australians at that time.
What sort of work were they doing?
They were assembling bicycles. They're also making a good thing out of it too. Because anything you could steal at that time, perhaps stealing's the wrong word, because all the goods in Singapore belonged to the Allies, or the British anyway, or the Allies, and the Japanese were just sending everything to Japan. But anything you could steal, you could sell to the Chinese. In this connection, the Chinese were allowed to bring into the camp each night what they called canteen goods, which broadly speaking meant anything really in the way of Western food, as long as you had enough money to pay for it. They would set up a long counter, right under the eyes of the Japanese guardroom, in fact, ready to trade with you on these things. Those of you who had money, of course, would go out and buy this stuff. You could buy meat and fish and butter, fruit, bread, eggs. But the Chinese was just as much interested in what they could buy from us, from what we would steal or pinch from the warehouses or go-downs. Anything would do, sewing machine needles, for example, cosmetics. As far as the Australians were concerned, it was bicycle parts. I'd made my bed down, I suppose, in this little hut I was assigned to, where these four Australians were working. And I was sitting having my evening meal, I suppose you'd call it. I'd bought about 20 cents from Changi with me. And I'd managed to buy a hard-boiled egg and duck egg and a piece of bread from this Chinese canteen place. And I was sitting there with some rice and eating this, and the Aussies came in and they said, "That's all you've got to... Is that all you've got for your tea, mate?" I said, "Well..." I said, "That's a jolly good tea." They said, "Well, wait on, we're not being out of the canteen yet." And one of them, it turned